Jeanne Flavelle's Hot Commodity Podcast Series. Empowering clients with commercial intelligence, supply chain expertise, and risk management solutions.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Nicole Thomas, Vice President of Information Services for McKinney Flavelle. Today is June 30th, 2020, and I want to welcome everyone to our Hot Commodity Podcast. And I have a special guest with me today. You've probably heard him speak on this platform before, but with me is Sean Bingham, founder of Absolute Return Research, also known as ABSR, who's going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff going on in the market today. How are you, Sean?
I am good. How are you, Nicole?
I am very well, because this is my Friday, number one. And the 4th of July is probably my second favorite holiday because I get to blow things up.
I was thinking about that today. It's 4th of July is absolutely one of my favorite holidays. It may be my favorite. I know Christmas is right there, but I love the 4th of July. Just love it for lots of reasons.
Fireworks, barbecue.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what more can you ask for? And days off of work.
Yeah, I am smoking some pork this weekend for sure.
Ooh,
I know.
Look at you.
I love
supporting the industry.
Of course I am.
Demand.
Of course I am.
You know, speaking of the industry, today, whoo, this is a big day.
Yeah.
Everyone usually is, you know, sitting there with bated breath waiting for the acreage and the grain stocks reports. But today offered a little bit of a surprise, I think, for most of the market. If we looked at, you know, I'll say this. Before I even saw the report, I saw the futures market.
Mm-hmm.
I was wrapping up a call and I took a look at the futures market and I saw that corn was up double digits and I said, uh-oh, something happened. What did that report say? And it looks like that acreage estimate for corn came in well below expectations at 92 million acres. The market was expecting something a little closer to 95 million. And so that that definitely threw things for a loop. And then soybean acreage, you know, much of the market expecting that to come up a little bit from the report at the end of March. And what we got instead was, you know, a pretty similar number, 83.8 million acres, still up 10% from 2019, but well below analyst expectations. And it's interesting, Sean, you know, something we've been talking about within the office this morning, looking at these numbers, both in the sense of acreage and seemingly a little over 4 million acres unspoken for with the corn acreage coming down so much. And then also looking at stocks, which I think corn number came in pretty close to where we were thinking. But wondering if there isn't room for that number to still grow a bit in 2019-20, add a little carry-in for 2020-21. And, you know, it's funny, I was running the numbers, and even with these lower number, this lower acreage number, we're still talking about, you know, conservatively 2.4 billion bushels of ending stocks. For most people over, you know, my career anyway, that, you know, 16% stocks to use ratio would be bearish. But
yeah,
hey, when you don't do what the market expects.
Yeah, this was definitely a surprise this morning on both ends of that. And as if the acreage number wasn't, you know, I think it was an outlier for a lot of reasons. One, the obvious, you know, the number itself. And number two, you know, the USDA has not exactly been aggressive moving numbers lately.
Right.
And this was an aggressive move.
Yes, it was.
So I think that's what surprised me the most. I think a lot of analysts have this USDA fudge factor that they put in these numbers that say, you know, the USDA just doesn't move that much. And, you know, this is kind of a one-off report, but it certainly surprised a lot of people. And I do think that stocks number has more room to move as well. So it was bullish for corn, and it's almost like someone knew it yesterday somehow.
Yeah, I know, right? All right, a little positioning.
I'm just throwing that out there. It's just kind of odd that this started yesterday. So,
well, we all telling our age, Sean, but you know, we've all watched Trading Places at some point in our lives, and can relate to that more as we decided to have a career in the industry that involves watching futures markets and waiting for reports to make decisions. But yeah, I mean, I think one thing that this will sort of play into, and why the market, you know, even beyond those trading futures, are so curious about, you know, where this could settle out, is understanding basis going into 2020 as well. You know, maybe now, if all this holds true, we see, you know, corn bottoming out in the low threes as opposed to sub three. And then for basis, you know, we were expecting, you know, pretty negative numbers, especially considering that at least initial projection of 3.4 billion bushels by the USDA. Now, maybe that doesn't seem, you know, quite as weak, probably still low on the from a historical perspective, because that's still, you know, a decent amount of corn. A 15 billion bushel crop is nothing to, you know, kind of shake off. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, for at least 3 months here, the expectation had been that things were going to just be ridiculously high. And I will say, certainly from my perspective, you know, and you and I have talked about this, we kind of scratched our head at the 97 million acres before when the number first came out. And then after COVID and some of the demand erosion that's taken place in that third quarter of the marketing year, you know, wonder if they may not, you know, change their minds about some of that. I just think the market, you know, didn't expect it to swing that dramatically.
Yeah, so there's no doubt. And you know, this takes at least corn kind of off that track that it was absolutely going lower, and has added some variance to it. And by variance, I mean volatility. And I think that will apply to basis as well. So what we thought was probably going to be a slow drift, no vol market over the next few months, this has thrown a bit of a monkey wrench into that.
Concurred.
Yeah. So
absolutely concurred.
It was interesting for sure.
Well, speaking of, you know, the monkey wrenches that can show up in the market, what do you think about the commitment of traders right now? How's the non-commercial side viewing this market? And do you have some thoughts on that?
I absolutely do. So, as you know, I do a pretty deep dive into the commitment of traders report every week. And I have a bit of a unique way of looking at it. And for those of your listeners and clients out there that aren't familiar with the Commitment of Traders report, I think you need to make this some of your regular reading or regular analysis when it comes to making decisions regarding any kind of commodity purchasing. So if you have risk exposure to commodities, this report is really important. And so what I'd like to kind of do, if you don't mind, is take a little history tour of why this report is so important.
Sure.
And how it's changed things, and you know, why it's become kind of mainstream for guys like me that like to follow it. So
educate us, Sean. Go for it.
So I'm going to jump back about 40 years.
Oh, wow.
I was not.
Did you know my birthday just?
I was.
Did you
not
know my birthday just passed, yeah. Sean? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm not saying that. I was not quite yet in the markets, but I was darn close. And what I want to do is I want to talk about, you know, why this report is so important. And to make a long story short, the reason it's important is because there is that proprietary or large speculator trading has gotten so large in commodities, and it pushes the market in ways that it never did 20 or 30 years ago. And what happened was, and this is a little bit of a history for guys who don't pay as much attention to, or didn't get the exposure to the futures market, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I know there's a lot of people in the industry a lot younger than I am. But back in 1983, there was a company called C&D Commodities that were run by two guys, Richard Dennis and Bill Eckhart, who were well known at the time to be some of the biggest and best traders in Chicago. And they had a belief that that they couldn't really compete with Cargill or the ADMs of the world on trying to discover value or trying to outsmart what those guys knew about the balance sheet. Sure. They just simply had too many boots on the ground.
Right.
And for, you know, a couple guys in Chicago on the floor or in an office, it was impossible to compete. So they decided, if we can't compete trying to find value, because as far as they were concerned, all knowable information was already reflected in the market in price, that the only way that they could make money was by trading movement or trend. And so they created this rules-based system. And to prove that they were correct, which they probably didn't have to, because at the time Richard Dennis was making the kind of money that Michael Milken was making at the time. A lot of people don't realize that. He was very wealthy trading. What they did is they created a little experiment, and it became known, as the Turtles. It took out an ad in a couple publications, including the Journal, and looking for some traders who just wanted to, looking for people who wanted to learn to trade. Whether they had any background at all in trading did not matter.
Okay.
And so they brought in about 14 people, and they gave them this set of rules, and they said, forget, we're not going to look at any kind of fundamentals. This is all rules on just momentum and trend. And if you're going to follow these rules, and you're going to trade, and we're going to give you money to do it. And so each one of them was given about $1 million to trade.
Oh, okay.
And of those 14, at least seven came out. Oh, well, they all made money to some extent. I mean, some of them not near as much, but a majority of them became famously wealthy. Some of the names that were in that list were Jerry Parker at Chesapeake Capital, Salem Abraham Trading, Liz Cheval at EMC, Tom Shanks at Hawksbill. So they became the biggest of the CTA players when this whole experiment was over, and people recognized what happened. Jerry Parker is probably, I mean, he was probably the best trader of the group. From 1980, when he left the Turtle Trading Group and started his own, from 1988 to 2006, he had one losing year.
Wow.
Yes.
Impressive.
Very impressive. And this is trading commodities. And he averaged about a 16.8% return a year.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Those are good odds.
Those were really good odds. And people like, you know, Abraham and Liz Cheval, they not quite the record, but very, very similar. And the returns were really, really impressive. And what it did is it got everyone's attention.
Sure.
And at the same time this was happening, we were seeing personal computing explode.
You're right.
And I believe it was at Lotus 1-2-3. The
wow.
Lotus 1-2-3.
You're old, Sean. Come
I'm
on.
Old.
Lotus 1-2-3.
And I did use that program. So that was coming on board. And so all of a sudden, not only could you use these rules, you could program these rules. And so
right.
between 1980, this is an interesting fact, between 1980 or in 1980, $1 of computing power paid for 9 billion computations. By 2010, the same dollar paid for 11 times or 11,000 times that number.
Wow.
Or about 100 million billion computations. So now you've got a method, and now you've got all this computing power, and the data was easy to get. And all of a sudden, the managed futures industry boomed.
Got it.
From 1985 to the end of 2019, managed futures assets grow from $1.5 billion to over $320 billion.
Wow.
And so when we're talking about this commitment of traders reports, we're talking about this $320 billion that is driving the commodities markets. Now, you might say, hey, Sean, well, you know, are some of those guys are, you know, obviously they're probably looking at fundamentals too. Well, according to Barclays Hedge, when you actually look at the numbers, 90% of that $320 billion is systematic. It's not discretionary. So they are not looking at the fundamentals. As a matter of fact, I hate to say this, my guess is most CTAs in the industry didn't even look at that number today.
Yeah.
Their algorithms just moved when the market moved.
Right, right.
And so while we do spend a lot of time looking at these fundamentals, and we should, the sheer amount of money that's not looking at that data, that is just trading on momentum and trend, you have to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
No, yep. I was just going to say, so Sean, it seems like, you know, it's one of those things where, to your point about momentum, that all it takes is potentially the one trader that sees the report, reacts to it, and then all these other traders and all this other money by effect pick up on that move, and it kind of, you know, creates this waterfall effect, which, you know, would kind of explain why being in this industry and watching futures markets, why it feels like these moves are more dramatic today, and not just today as in, you know, in current times, than they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Absolutely, because it's instantaneous. The minute the market, you know,
right.
My guess is, you know, the commercials obviously saw this move. You get your older time traders who saw it. So this was a surprise. The buying starts, and as soon as the buying starts, the algorithms kick in, and they kick in from the high frequency guys all the way out to the long term trader guys. But you have an enormous amount of money flowing into the market electronically because of moves like this. And so it's really important to know how these guys are positioned on a week-to-week basis, because it does impact the market. And the fact that the specs were already heavily, heavily short corn today coming into this,
right?
I'm sure exacerbated the move.
Sure.
So one of the things I thought we'd do is, because I'm sure the people listening out there are thinking, well, how does this, as a procurement guy, how does this help me
exactly
make decisions on buying?
Right.
So one of the things that I do in my analysis is I go way beyond just looking at what their actual positions are. I actually like to calculate where their positions are. Not only how much do they have, but what's the most likely place that they have it.
Yeah.
So if we look at the commitment of traders reports between March 11th and June 9th, that's where large speculators, and by large speculators, I mean managed money traders and other reportables. Those are the big players.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They sold 231,000 futures and option equivalents in corn in that period.
Right.
That represents 90% of the current short interest, according to my calculations, in the market. Now, the range during that period was about 315 to 377 in the September contract, and that's probably where they are because they'll always gravitate, you know, to the most liquid futures.
Sure.
So,
right.
So if we look at volume at price data, and where there was, you know, significant support and resistance, we can come up with a pretty good idea where they're short. And according to my data, I had them short around 338 with the September reference. Now, that's interesting, I guess. And it's interesting that they're short, you know, they were short 260,000 contracts coming into this report. But what's even more interesting is now that we know what happened over that time frame, and we know about where they put those positions on, we can take another more interesting step. And I've had a lot of people call me and say, "Hey, man, how low can corn go?"
Right.
Well, let me tell you what the speculators are saying, or what their models are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do it as a commodity trading advisor, which I did for a long time, when you put on a trade, you have a very, very specific risk-reward profile.
Right.
We don't just buy it because we want to buy it. We buy it because we think that the reward will outweigh the risk.
Of course.
Well, trading is a lot like baseball. If you can bat 300, you're a rock star.
You're doing great.
You're doing exactly. Really, really well. Now, that number, that 33% number, is kind of a normal metric for what most trading firms make on a trade. So one out of every three trades is profitable on a good system.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me, okay, well, if I'm going to put a trade on, I have to make three times more than I'm going to risk just to break even over time.
Right.
So right. They usually do something like 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 risk reward ratios for a trade. Now, what do we risk? Most CTAs use a volatility measure combined with some assets under management measure to calculate what they will call sometimes their load, their, you know, what they're going to risk and their position.
Right.
So on the risk section, when we look at volatility, a lot of traders, and I'm one too, that I like to look at average true range because it's very intuitive, whereas volatility seems, you know, it's kind of a hard number to get your head around. Whereas average true range is easy to understand. So
Sure. The
average true range during that period I was talking about when they were selling was a little under 8 cents per bushel for corn.
Okay.
So most traders will risk somewhere between 1.5 and 2 average true ranges as their initial exit. And the reason they do that is they want to give their trade enough room not to get stopped out.
Right, exactly.
But at the same time, they can't risk, you know, they can't have these giant risk parameters.
Right.
So if we're looking back at our ratio and we say, okay, if they're going to risk maybe, you know, if they're going to do a 3-to-1 or a 4-to-1 risk reward ratio, and we know that the risk is about 8 cents a day. So if we double that to give ourselves 2 ATRs a room, and I know I'm getting a little weeds here,
yeah.
That gives us about 16 cents.
Okay? Right.
So they're going to risk about 16 cents on this trade from that number we calculated, 338. Well, what that means is if I say I'm going to play on a 4-to-1 ratio, for every one unit of risk, I need 4 units of reward. That means that 16 cents times 4, 60, you know, roughly 62 cents, that's how much lower the market needs to go. That's what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, based on a 1-to-3 or a 1-to-4 ratio, when they put all these trades on, 230,000 contracts plus, they're looking for the market to go somewhere down to 276 to 290.
Right.
Just based on, or they wouldn't even put the trade on.
Sure.
Because otherwise it's a losing proposition for
right.
them. So if you're a procurement person, you're going, well, how low, you know, where do I need to be looking to buy?
Right.
You know, I still believe that the fundamentals are going to continue to draw this market down, you know, particularly before this report, but you know, where should I be looking to buy? Well, that's the level. Somewhere in that 276, 290 range is where these guys are probably going to be taking position back. And they've got a lot to take back. So that's just one example of how we can use the reports. They're you know, every one of them is a little different. You know, they're,
sure.
You know, soybean has a different profile right now.
Sure.
But
I'll tell you what, Sean, I think you just made a lot of people. You just made a lot of people that were nervous after today's rally feel a little better. They're going to sleep better tonight. Because they're gonna remember that they have the potential still to get those futures, at least December, down into the 270s, 280s.
Yeah, well, it's certainly what the speculators are looking for, and I'm sure. I'm sure there was some buying today. So, you know, any of the weak shorts probably came out,
right.
But this is still a very heavily shorted market in corn. And that's kind of their expectations, or they would not have put those trades on in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just another tool to use when you're trying to make these decisions. And there's some basis in fact behind it. So it's not just lines drawn on a chart. Right. These are hard, real and hard numbers. And, you know, we would be, you know, anyone interested in digging into them, be happy to help them.
Yeah, no, to that point, Sean, certainly to all our clients and those that would like to be someday, this is stuff that, you know, we talk about. This is one reason why McKinney pursued a relationship and have been glad to welcome Sean to the team and coming up with solutions for our clients. Because like him, we recognize that, you know, there's the fundamental piece and that can give you a good long-term perspective. But there, it helps, if nothing else, makes you feel a little more comfortable to have other tools to use in deciding what can be a pretty big decision of as to where and when and how much to cover of a given market. And Sean does this for corn, soybean oil, number 11 sugar, wheat, and even some of the livestock pieces. So I would certainly invite anyone to reach out to us at McKinney Flavell or directly to Sean at ABSR to talk more about this. And certainly for McKinney Flavell's customers, we'd be happy to get you on the phone with Sean to kind of talk about how this can work for your specific situation. So I learned something, Nishan. I've got a bunch of names to look up on Wikipedia now. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are still going. So yeah. Absolutely. This was wonderful. This was wonderful. I'm glad you had me. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate always, Sean, when you come to the podcast, because you definitely offer a different perspective that I think is very much warranted in understanding what to do in these markets, but also just in from an educational standpoint. So thank you for being here. And as we sign off here, one thing I do want to point listeners towards is one of our associates, Eric Thornton, is traveling through the Midwest this week.
Yes, he is.
He made a drive from California. He's ultimately going to end up in New York, and that's going to take him through Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. And he's already starting to post some pictures and some commentary of what he's seeing out there for this corn crop and soybean crop. So definitely log into IQ to check those out. He's going to be posting those every day. So have a little something else to digest in thinking about what's to come in these markets. But with that, I would, as always, say thank you to everyone for checking out the podcast, and thanks for listening. Have a happy and safe 4th of July.
Very safe.
Very safe. Don't blow off any fingers, please. Exactly. And as Mike always says, let's live with an attitude of gratitude and embody a mentality of empathy. So until next time, everyone, take care.
Goodbye, everyone.
That concludes this podcast episode. For expanded commentary and more detailed information, log on to McKinney Flavell's IQ Ingredient Intelligence platform and listen to our Market Insights podcast. If you're not a subscriber, visit McKinney-Flavell.com for more information. And as always, follow us on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter.